First versus the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, case number 03654. Respondent to call your next witness.
Yes, we'd like to call Dr. Christine McCusker.
Dr. McCusker, right here.
Right here?
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Would you proceed?
Thank you. Good morning, Dr. McCusker. Would you please state and spell your name for the record?
It's Christine McCusker, and the last name is spelled M-C-C-U-S-K-E-R.
And what is your profession?
I'm a pediatric immunologist.
And what is your current title?
I'm an assistant professor of pediatrics and a research director at McGill University and Montreal Children's Hospital.
Doctor, would you briefly describe your educational background?
I did a bachelor's in microbiology and immunology at the University of Toronto, and following that, I did a master's in molecular virology at McMaster University, followed by 3 years of a PhD in immunology, also at McMaster. Following that, I did my medical degree at McMaster University and then moved to McGill University, where I did a fellowship or a residency in pediatrics, followed by a fellowship in allergy and clinical immunology, and then followed that with a 2-year postdoctoral fellowship in fundamental immunology research at the Meekins Christie Laboratories at McGill.
And are you board certified?
I am certified in the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada in both pediatrics and allergy and immunology, as well as the Collège des Médecins de Québec in Canada. As well, I have a board certification in pediatrics in the United States.
Excuse me. And Doctor, would you briefly highlight some of the honors that you have received in your career?
During my postdoctoral fellowship, I received a salary award from the Canadian Society of Allergy and Clinical Immunology for 2 years to support my work. I've also a clinician researcher through the Fonds de Recherche en Santé du Québec, the Foundation for Health Research in Quebec, where they have supported me with awards twice now. They're 2 to 4 year awards.
And of what professional organizations are you a member?
I'm a member of the Canadian Allergy and Immunology Society, the CSACI. I'm a member of the Allergy and Immunology Association of Quebec. I'm a member of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada. I think that might be about all.
And do you hold any teaching positions in your specialty?
Yes, I'm an assistant professor at McGill University, so my teaching requirements include teaching undergraduate students basic immunology in the science microimmuno programs. I also teach the medical school students both basic and clinical allergy and immunology, and I teach graduate students and postdoctoral fellows in the graduate school at McGill.
And do you hold any laboratory positions?
I'm the clinical director of the clinical immunology laboratory at Montreal Children's Hospital.
And what are your research laboratory responsibilities?
My appointment is 50% of clinical duties and 50% research duties, and I'm a research director at the Meekins Christie Laboratories, where I run a fundamental research lab working on immunoregulation of the immune system in through development, so in a model of infancy through adulthood.
And what division of your time is spent between your research and your clinical work? Is it 50-50?
Theoretically.
Approximately how many patients do you see per month?
On a monthly basis, to break it down, it was probably in the order of 200 to 300, depending on the month.
And are the majority of those patients children?
Almost all of them are children.
And do you have a general pediatric practice as well?
I work both in two different practices for general pediatrics. The first is at a private clinic where I fill in for doing what's called emergency visits or walk-ins. And the second is through the emergency room where I act as an emergentologist.
Approximately how many of those patients do you see per week?
So it varies depending on the week, but it's probably about 50 patients a week.
Are you an examiner for any licensing boards?
I'm an examiner for the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada for allergy and clinical immunology.
And what does that mean to be an examiner?
Well, you're asked to or invited to participate on the examination boards. If you have, you have to be nominated by your peers in the specialty, and then you're invited to be an examiner on the boards, and you're responsible for the development of examination questions for the specialty as well as the oral exam component, where you're examining the fellows who have completed their training and who are asking to be allowed to practice as specialists.
Okay. And have you published in the field of pediatric immunology?
Yes.
Are those publications referenced on your CV?
Yes, they are.
Are they all peer-reviewed?
Yes, they are.
Are you a reviewer for any scientific journals?
Yes, I am.
Which ones? Name a few.
I've been a reviewer for the Blue Journal, which is the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. I've been a reviewer for the Journal of Immunology. I've been a reviewer for the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. I've been a reviewer for Clinical and Experimental Allergy, Clinical and Experimental Immunology, the Annals of Allergy and Immunology. There might be a couple more.
And have you ever testified as an expert witness in a legal case?
Yes, I have.
Approximately how many times?
I've been involved, this would be my fourth case.
And did you testify in the Cedillo case?
Yes, I did.
After turning to this case, did you review Yates-Hazelhurst medical records that have been filed?
Yes, I have.
And did you review the expert report of Dr. Corbier?
Yes, I did.
And do you agree with Dr. Corbier that Yates has a weakened immune system or a compromised immune system?
No, I do not.
Does he have a dysregulated immune system?
I see no evidence for a dysregulated immune system.
Based on your review of the records, do you believe that Yates' immune system is at all abnormal?
No, I do not.
In your opinion, doctor, did the vaccinations that Yates received cause or contribute to his autism?
No, I do not think so.
Would your opinion change if it was determined that Yates' developmental regression began at 12 months, as the family and Dr. Corbier allege?
No.
I'd like to turn specifically to the facts of this case. And before you took the stand, did I hand to you Petitioner's Exhibit 16?
Yes, you
just
did.
For the record. Okay. Before we get to that, I'd like to talk about the upper respiratory tract infections that Yates had during the first 2 years of his life. Do you recall seeing those notations in the records?
Yes, I do.
Is this evidence to you of a weakened immune system?
No.
Why not?
As I elucidated in my report, I looked at the frequency of infection that this child experienced and found that it was not, he did not have a frequency of infection that was any more or less than his peer group. His frequency was somewhere in the order of 4 physician-diagnosed upper respiratory tract infections and 7 ear infections, 5 of which were associated with documented viral illnesses. That is entirely within keeping with a normal range of infection or a normal frequency of infection in a child of his age.
Could you briefly describe or explain the immune system of a child up to 2 years old?
Briefly.
In a nutshell, I know that's your profession.
Briefly?
In a nutshell.
Essentially, when a child is first born, obviously their immune system, although partly protected by the maternal antibodies, their immune system is essentially having to learn from first principles how to fight and combat infection, and to remember how these infections look like so that they can fight them again should the need arise. And so usually in the first 4 months, children don't have that high a frequency of infection. But as the maternal antibodies begin to wane, the infection frequency increases. Now, in this particular child, for example, he was the third child in the family, so there would have been more circulation of viruses.
I believe he was the firstborn child.
Is he the firstborn?
He was the firstborn child. Right.
Oh.
There are some cousins, but in the immediate family, okay. He's the firstborn.
Well, the circulation of viruses begins fairly early on in a child's life, usually between the ages of 4 and 6 months, is when they start to catch their first infections. From the age of 6 months to the age of somewhere, and it depends on the child, two to three, a child will catch probably in the range of 6 to 10 infections per year. That's the average that a general pediatrician would look at as within the normal range. Some children have a few more, some children have a few less, but that's sort of the range. In that time period, their immune system is learning. And what it's learning to do is it's learning to recognize the infections and fight them and to generate what's called immunological memory. That immunological memory allows them, the next time they see the infection, to fight it without apparent illness. That doesn't mean that they don't see the viruses, they don't come into contact with the same number of viruses, because obviously they do. It's just they don't manifest the illness as frequently as they would early on in the first 2 years of life. So somewhere between the ages of 2 and 6, the frequency of infection begins to decrease significantly. And so by the time a child is sort of through the first year of school, past grade one, you see that their school absences and their frequency of infection markedly decreases. And that's because their immune system has learned, and so they're not manifesting illness as quickly.
Now, you briefly touched on yeast otitis media infections. How many otitis media infections did you see documented in the medical records? Approximately how many?
I actually counted 7.
Is that
in
normal?
The first 2 years of life.
Is that a normal amount?
That's within the normal range. Now, some children have more, some children have less.
Now, Yates had tubes put in his ears, correct?
Yes.
If Yates' immune system were abnormal or weakened, what would you expect would be the clinical course of future infections following the installation of tubes?
As a general rule, you put tubes in the ears to allow the ear canals to drain freely because the eustachian tube is blocked from usually the mucus in the nose. So you put the tubes in the ears to allow the mucus and the accumulated liquid from the inner ear to drain out to the outside. And that prevents or reduces the frequency at which those kind of blocking of the nose will allow the bacteria or the virus to grow in the ear and manifest itself as an ear infection. So you put the tubes in, you will expect to see a decrease in the frequency of infection following the installation of tubes.
Is that with a normal immune system?
Yes.
What about if one's immune system were abnormal or weakened and he or she had tubes put in? What would you expect the clinical course of infections to become?
As a general rule, in the patients that we follow with primary immunodeficiency who have documented problems with their immune system, the installation of tubes may somewhat reduce the frequency of ear infections, but does not completely eliminate it. The tubes frequently block because the amount of inflammatory mediators generated is generally much higher in those patients. So they often have trouble even with the installation of tubes. In addition, their immune system is compromised, and it's compromised from birth. So their frequency of infection does not change. It's just the characteristics of the infection changes. And these children go on to have more sinusitis, for example, and they also go on to have lower respiratory tract infections such as pneumonias. So what you see in the clinical course is you'll see a baby who has many otitis media developing to pneumonia to sinusitis.
Did you see evidence of that in the medical records of this case?
No, I did not.
Now, Dr. Corby in his report states that Yates developed chronic, and I'm going to butcher the word,
lymphadenopathy?
It's easy for you to say, yes. Swollen lymph nodes, right?
That's correct.
Did you see evidence of this in the medical records?
No, I did not. There was one episode where the parents brought Yates in because they were concerned about, because they could feel some lymph nodes in the child's neck, but it was noted as the physician to be within normal. That's I'm just looking for the it's about 9 months of age. There was one notice. I don't actually have it written in my notes because it wasn't considered normal. But there was one, and it would be in the record. I'm sorry.
Are swollen or palpable lymph nodes normal in young children?
Yes.
But doctor, if lymph nodes are indeed swollen, is that a sign of a healthy immune system?
It's a question of degree. Certainly, we expect that, especially in the first years of life, that you will have what's called palpable lymph nodes, particularly in the back of the neck or the posterior cervical chain. And that's in part a sign that the immune system is responding normally to the onslaught of infectious agents that it's seeing. And also, it's in part an issue of children actually don't have a lot of subcutaneous tissue in their neck, so you can feel the nodes much easier than you can in an adult. So we expect in pediatrics to palpate, touch lymph nodes, particularly in the back of the neck, sometimes in the front and all the way down into the just above the clavicles here, and that's considered to be normal. It's the draining lymph nodes from the head and neck, and to be able to feel them as small, shoddy nodes is normal.
There's all. Go ahead.
For the record, reference to mom and the lymph nodes, the petitioner's exhibit 222, and that's at about 7 months.
At 7 months.
September 5th, 2000.
And it was noted, I think, by the doctor to be normal. Sorry.
Now, doctor, there's also been testimony in this case that Yates's head felt constantly hot after his first birthday. It was described as possibly a low-grade fever. Does that have any clinical value to a pediatrician or a pediatric immunologist?
I would say no. In truth, children have a temperature range, and it's quite broad, ranging anywhere. Now, in Celsius, anywhere from sort of 36 to 38.5. And in Fahrenheit, that would be up to 101.3 as core temperature. And that's considered normal. And our normal variations are some children run sort of around 100, some children run at the classic 98.6, and some children run at, 97 and a little bit lower than your classic core body temperature. And it's within normal. As long as it is below 101.3 or 38.5, it is not fever and it is not abnormal. It's just normal metabolic rate and normal metabolic variance. Parents sometimes come in to me and say, I brought him in because he feels hot, or I brought him in because he's sweating, or every time I put a blanket on him, he kicks it off because he's too hot. And all those things are concerns that parents will raise to you as a doctor, and you go and you measure the child's temperature core, and it's completely normal, and you evaluate the child, and there's nothing wrong with the child. So feeling hot is not significant unless it correlates with the presence of fever. Children, as a general rule, if they are truly feverish, have a change in their behavior such that they tend to be more sleepy, they tend to be more quiet, they tend to be less interactive. So the parents note that usually before they note the feeling warm.
Now, the records also reflect that Yates had several episodes of candida, or thrush. Do you recall seeing those records?
Yes.
How many documented episodes of thrush do you recall seeing?
I counted three that were documented as a notation in the notes as seeing a thrush, and then there were two others that I found a reference to but couldn't find the actual physician note saying what they saw, and so I qualified those as sort of possible or probable. And then there was the episode where he was treated because of the dermatitis of his thumb, which was treated in case, in quotation marks, in the physician note.
Assume for purposes of argument that there were five episodes of thrush. Would that be abnormal?
In a child with absolutely nothing who is 5 or 6 years old, that's abnormal. In a child who is between the ages of 0 and 2, that is considered to be something that happens. I think that it's something that you would note, but you wouldn't necessarily worry about, especially in a child who, such as in this case, was a thumb sucker, because that promotes the adherence of the candida to the oral mucosa. And as well, in the case of a child who required a lot of antibiotic use.
What is candida or thrush?
Candida is a yeast or a fungus. It's colonized, found in our mouths, and in most children they're found colonized with candida in the oral mucosa. It's a commensal organism. We don't usually, it usually is competed out by other organisms in the mouth, so you usually don't get an infection, in quotation marks, with it.
Is it normal in young children?
Very common in young children.
Are developmentally delayed children more prone to candida?
It seems that children with developmental delay have more frequency of candida, yes.
And why is that?
There's several different theories on that. Most of the feeling is it has to do with the mouthing behaviors, but it's largely unknown.
And does the chance of developing candida increase with antibiotic use?
Yes, it does. That's considered a risk factor.
Is Yates' experience with candida evidence of a systemic immunodeficiency or a compromised immune system?
Yates' frequency of candida infection, with or without the fact that we know his immune system is normal from the immune workup, the frequency of candida infection is there. It's not zero. In the face of the frequent antibiotic use, you could explain it. Mm-hmm. But in and of itself, that would be something that might warrant examination of the immune system to ensure that there is no underlying other cause other than the ones that we already know, the mouthing behaviors and the frequent antibiotic use. So the answer is, I guess, yes and no. In the face of the immune workup that was done, the child's immune system was completely normal, and any abnormality that you would be looking for in a child who has recurrent thrush, which is abnormalities in the functioning of the T cells, really wasn't found.
In fact, that's exactly what the pediatrician questioned. You were presented today with a new record dated January 18th, 2002, a pediatric record, is that
mm-hmm.
correct? What was reflected on that record, to the best of your recollection?
It was the family had come in questioning the frequency of the child's infections with thrush, and the physician felt that it, while, again, explainable by the extant circumstances of the child's first 2 years of life, was enough to warrant a further immune evaluation.
Pardon me, for the record, just so we know what that record is, I'm going to designate that as Petitioner's Trial Exhibit 2.
Absolutely.
And that immune function testing was done, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And that was tested in August 2002 by Dr. Blase, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And I'm referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 16. Do you have a copy of that in front of you?
Yes, I do.
And I'm specifically referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 16 at 3. What do the medical records say about Yates' immunoglobulin levels?
According to the medical records, they're entirely within normal limits for age.
And what's the purpose of testing immunoglobulin levels?
The immunoglobulin levels themselves are a fairly reasonable screen to determine whether or not there's a profound immunodeficiency. In and of itself, it's just a level, and it doesn't necessarily denote function. You can have children who have normal levels but poor function. So it is a good first step, and it denotes that his body was able to make antibodies and to maintain a level. The more important study or result is the fact that when his immune system was asked to make an immune response, so that when he received his diphtheria and tetanus vaccine, and he was asked to make a response to tetanus, he was able to do that.
Just for the record, you're referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 16 at 9?
Let me just verify, but I believe so. It's repeated a few times during that. Yes. So essentially, when you're doing an immune evaluation of a child, you're asking two different questions. The first question is, do we have the building blocks? Are the numbers of all the building blocks, that means the T cells, the B cells, the other cells of the immune system, and the antibody levels, are they within a normal range? That's your first step. And then the next question, and really for an immunologist, the more important question is, not really, it doesn't matter if you have 1,000 T cells if none of them function. So what you really want to know is, can we make these T cells and B cells talk to each other, and can we make them function to generate immunity that's long-lasting? What the tetanus antibody tells me is it's actually a very good screen, because in order to make tetanus antibody, in order to have a level, you actually have to have a fairly comprehensive immune system. You have to have B cells that are present, and the B cells have to be able to make antibodies. But most B cells can't make antibody by themselves. They actually have to be told what to do. So what you really need to do is you need to have the T cells that are there and that can recognize the tetanus in this case and tell the B cell, okay, go ahead, make the antibody. So what the presence of that specific antibody tells me is that his body was able to see these antigens. They were able to recognize them as something that you should make an antibody to. The T cells were able to talk to the B cells, and the B cells could do their job. So that tells me you have a very comprehensive functioning immune system from a specific or adaptive point of view.
And what were the findings for Yates' complement levels? And I'm referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 16 at 4.
He had normal complement levels, and as well, they also did the complement function, the total hemolytic complement. And again, levels are interesting, and they're very helpful, and if they're abnormal, they tell us something. But normal levels in and of themselves don't necessarily tell us that the immune system is competent. But Dr. Blase here went the step further, and he said, can I make it function? If I demand this complement system to work, will it function? And it did, completely normally.
And what were the findings for the T and B cell numbers?
They were entirely normal for age.
Doctor, did the testing of Yates' immune system in August 2002 show any evidence of immune dysfunction?
No.
Or immune compromise?
No.
Are you satisfied with the testing that was done by Dr. Blase in August of 2002?
Yes, I am.
And Dr., was Yates also tested for antibodies to Candida?
Yes, he was.
And I'm referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 17 at 3. What were the results?
They were negative.
Does that mean he did not have antibodies to the Candida?
It means that he did not have an infection of Candida that was invasive. Children with primary immunodeficiency, when they do have problems with Candida, their Candida tends not to remain in their mouths. It tends to become invasive. And so invasive candidiasis is a sign of a compromised immune system. And in that situation, children will make antibodies to Candida. If it remains local, sort of just on the skin or in the oral mucosa or even in the diaper area, you do not make antibodies to Candida. And there are papers that are quoted in my report that have looked at that in normal children.
Dr. Turning to the date of vaccination, February 8th of 2001, the medical records reflect, and there is testimony that Yates was sick that day that he received his vaccinations. Is being sick with an upper respiratory infection and a fever a contraindication to vaccination?
No. The Red Book, which is sort of the infectious disease Bible that's used by many physicians, does not recommend withholding a vaccine from a child because of a upper respiratory tract infection or with or without fever. And specifically when they look at the live viral vaccines, specifically the MMR, studies have shown that the presence of fever and upper respiratory tract infection do not compromise your ability to mount an immune response to measles, mumps, or rubella under those circumstances. And so particularly for the live viral vaccines, it is not a contraindication. If a child is considered to be severely ill, then the vaccine is withheld. But a child with a cold and an ear infection needing some antibiotics would not warrant withholding vaccine.
Dr. Yates had or has an immunodeficiency, as Dr. Corbier opines. What would you expect to be his clinical course throughout the 7 years of his life?
If you have a primary immunodeficiency, it's something you're born with, the immune system will struggle to try and keep ahead of the infections, but essentially over time, the child would become sicker and sicker and sicker with recurrent infections. And that's really what we see. While children with immunodeficiency can have ear infections in the first year of life, by the time they're two or three, they've already had one or two or three pneumonias because their immune system just cannot cope with the flood of viruses and bacteria that they're being exposed to. And it gets weaker and weaker and weaker, and eventually they present and are diagnosed with their primary immunodeficiency. That's children who have more subtle immunodeficiencies. Obviously, those that have severe combined immunodeficiency, where their immune systems don't work at all, present very early on in life, usually within the first year. And those children are very sick and will die without medical intervention. So when we're talking about the more subtle immunodeficiencies, what you really find is that you have a child who maybe in the first 2 years of life was sick, maybe a little bit more sick than his peers, but as time goes on, they continue to be sick. They don't have that period where they're well. And really, these children are never well.
Did you see any evidence of that in the medical records in this case?
No, I did not. This child followed the normal course of few infections in the first two years of life and a slow or a predictable reduced frequency as he aged, at least in the records that I reviewed.
Doctor, would an immune defect ever resolve or dissipate over time?
A true primary immunodeficiency does not. And that would be something that has clinical relevance.
Is there any evidence in your experience as a pediatric immunologist that, as Dr. Corbier states, immune mechanisms are implicated in autism?
No.
Is there any reliable medical evidence in the peer-reviewed literature that immune mechanisms are implicated in autism?
Not that I have been able to find.
In your practice, have you tested the immune profiles of autistic children?
Yes, I have.
Approximately how many?
Oh, at least 100, perhaps more. Hard to know exactly.
Over what time period?
About 8 years.
And among the approximately 100 autistic children that you have tested, how many have had an immune deficiency?
One.
I have no further questions.
Thank you. I'm sorry for the interruption. You were asking questions about whether there was some significance to the fact that Yates' grandmother reported that he seemed constantly warm during his second year of life.
Mm-hmm.
Can a low-grade fever that persists for a long period of time be an evidence of chronic infection?
I have never seen a report of that. I guess it would depend on what you would define as low-grade fever. I would say, off the top of my head, no.
If a child, and you indicated that there was a fairly broad, at least sound broad to me, variety of normal temperatures for individuals.
Yes.
But if a child was, in fact, was beyond that normal range.
Yes.
For 6 months. Would that merit some kind of evaluation?
I suppose it would merit that kind of, some kind of evaluation, except that I've never seen a case report of a child with documented fever for more than 6 months. During those 6 months, one would presume that this child had been seen by his pediatrician, and there would have been a note of it in the case history, but I failed to find a note of fever, a significant frequency of fever in the case history notes. Children, I'll give you an example. We've recently followed a child who does have a primary immunodeficiency who presented to our hospital with a history of fever for a month. Now that child had had weight loss. That child had had significant symptomatology associated with that and did have what's called an immune activation syndrome, macrophage activation syndrome, that was clearly and easily documented by the testing that was done. But that was after a month of fever, and this child was quite sick and very close to death at the time when she presented to the hospital. So 6 months, I think, would be unbelievably unusual and would warrant a case report.
It would warrant some kind of immunological
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I would think that 6 months of daily fever, to that extent, even quote-unquote low grade, which would be 38.5 and above core, would significantly debilitate the child. Wouldn't just be a child who felt warm. It would be a child who didn't grow.
How about kids that develop sinusitis? Am I pronouncing that right?
Sinusitis.
Sinus infection.
Mm-hmm.
Those infections persist for months, do they not?
The mucosal thickening can persist for a long time. The infections can, the bacteria can remain in the sinuses for a while, but clinical sinusitis is actually a relatively acute event. There are two different etiologies. There's acute and chronic sinusitis. Acute sinusitis is the one that's characterized by facial pain and fever. Chronic sinusitis is the one that's characterized by chronic congestion and is usually in the absence of fever.
Usually? Does that mean that there are cases that in which you have a chronic sinusitis in which there is a
What generally
fever
happens is you have...
Despite the absence of acute infection symptoms?
No. In fact, when I say usually, what I mean is that a patient will come in. I mean, as an allergist, I see a lot of sinusitis. a patient will come in and there will be a history of nighttime snoring, poor sleep, chronic congestion, a nasal voice, you know, not being able to breathe through the nose, anosmia, which is unable to smell, which is really a sign of a chronic congestion of the sinuses. And so you would call that child to have chronic sinusitis. Now, sinusitis doesn't necessarily mean infection, it means inflammation. So you would have inflammation of the sinuses. But the reason they're coming to you, because the parents assume it's just a snotty kid and don't think that it's worthy of coming to the doctor. So the reason the child's come to you is because now he's developed a fever and green nasal discharge and now has an acute sinusitis over top of what really is a chronic inflammation of the sinuses. So when the child presents to medical attention, it's when the symptoms become acute as opposed to when they're chronic. Kids with chronic sinusitis who present, because they do too, it's true. It's because they've been waking up at night, they're have poor sleep and things like that. And that's usually a sign of inflammation of the sinuses and is often related to the presence of allergens in the environment and things like that, and not related to acute infection. So chronic things are, chronic sinusitis in particular, it's usually not an infectious process.
Do you have a sense of what percentage of children develop a thrush infection, a candida infection, in their first year of life?
There's something in the order of 1 in 3 will have thrush in the first year of life. Mm-hmm. It's quite common, 30%.
And how many did you count in the first year of Yates Hazelhurst's life?
I counted, as I mentioned, 3 documented thrush and sort of, not in the first year, sorry, 3 documented, 2 probables in the first 2 years.
How many? I'm sorry, 17.
Sorry, 3 documented that I was able to find documentation for, and 2 more probable infections in the first 2 years of life.
3 and 2, did you say?
Yeah, 5.
Now, is that, do you have any idea of how many children would develop 5 in the first 2 years of life?
The studies have not been done, so no is the short answer. The long answer is, in a child who receives antibiotics, it's not unusual for you to have a problem with thrush.
One thing you did say when you were discussing thrush was that that some of the findings would be different for a child who sucked his thumb and one of those who didn't. Is that correct?
No, I didn't. I actually said that children who mouth, so who suck their thumbs or suck soothers, or, you know, have a blanket that's always in their mouth or something like that, who tend to be mouthers, that's a risk factor for recurrent thrush. So that's, it's just a risk factor.
So your opinion wouldn't change based on the extent to which Yates sucked his thumb?
It's like everything else in life. It's a risk factor. It accumulates or not.
Now, I'm going to hand you again that January 18, 2002 physician's visit that's been marked as Petitioner's Trial Exhibit 2. And I again apologize for having only the one copy. I guess the question I have is, do you agree with the note in the pediatrician's records that we should consider an immune evaluation in this child's case if this kind of problem continues to persist?
Yes, I agree. I also should note that we see these patients all the time. In my practice as a clinical immunologist, we're referred patients who have recurrent otitis media. We're referred patients with recurrent thrush. We're referred patients with recurrent pneumonias even. And we will see 15 patients a week referred in to evaluate their immune system. We will diagnose primary immunodeficiency 6, maybe 10 times a year. And 10 times a year would be considered a banner year. So that means that I evaluate hundreds of children for immune, quote-unquote, deficiencies based on the history of their infections and the type of infections they have. And these are even children who have severe invasive infections, meningitis and septicemia. And they don't have a bad immune system. They just got a bad bug. So the incidence of primary immunodeficiency, while from my point of view I think it's important, from the general population point of view, we evaluate a lot of normal children with the same history.
I suppose that's the fundamental question I have. You said that if these 10 or 15 a week that you will look at, that might be somewhat like Yates-Hazlehurst in his first 2 years of life. Is that right?
That's correct.
And so there are a large number of children who merit an immune workup.
Yes.
Because they fit a profile somewhat like Yates-Hazlehurst.
It's not really because they fit a profile. It's because our thinking about immunodeficiency has changed. And it's a bit philosophical, and I'm going to get on a little soapbox. I hope you don't mind about this. But the truth is that in the 80s and 90s, the frequency of the time from onset of first infection to diagnosis of primary immunodeficiency was somewhere in the order of 5 to 6 years. And immunologists looked at that and said, well, that's not right. And really, essentially, children had to follow that pattern that I talked about, where they had to have the frequency of infections in the first 2 years of life, and then it just not go away, and they were getting more and more debilitated, and then finally somebody looked at their immune system. And what has happened is that through campaigns to make primary caregivers aware that primary immunodeficiency should be examined, children are referred earlier for looking at their immune system. Now, because we don't know what's going to happen after age 2 or age 3, whether or not they're just going to behave like every other kid, or whether they're going to have this downward spiral, it is better to catch them at 18 months or age 2 and start treatment if you can. That's really the goal. So the purpose of having a lot of these evaluations and my knowing that when I walk into clinic on Tuesday morning, I'm going to see 15 kids and probably all of them will be normal, is that I pick up that one and then I make an improvement in that one child's life. But the truth is, based on history alone, you can't make a diagnosis of immunodeficiency because infections happen. And so the frequency of infections happen, and it's not an indicator of a primary immunodeficiency. It's an indicator that maybe you should look. Having said that, I have children who I diagnose at 9 or 10 with a primary immunodeficiency who have had really nothing from 0 to 10. So infection is a sign, and it should be examined, but it doesn't make the diagnosis. It doesn't even say the child's immune system is abnormal by any means, and it may not even be there in a child who has a clearly abnormal immune system. So in and of itself, it's helpful. It gives us information. It warrants a consult, and it warrants an evaluation. But the evaluation, when done, is clear.
Now, this is what I'm trying to ask, and maybe I misheard you. Did you say that some of these 15 or 30 or 90 that you see that end up not having primary immune deficiencies might have an efficient immune system? Did you use the term, like, I thought you said something about bad immune systems as something different than primary immune deficiency. Am I incorrect there?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. No.
I'm trying to understand is, do I understand that kids that have primary immune deficiencies, this is a serious and often lifelong condition that requires attention because they can't deal with infections?
Yes. It's always lifelong unless you intervene.
As opposed to these children, are there some children that just don't deal with infections well but don't have a primary immune deficiency?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. there is a range of what is considered normal. So if you have a child who has 10 infections in a year, is your child not dealing well with infection versus the kid who only had three? That's hard to know. Or did they just come into contact with the virus at a different time? There are many, it's multifactorial. And really, in pediatrics, what are you looking at? You have to look at the child. You have to say, is he growing? Is he missing a lot of school? Is he not missing a lot of school? Are these infections, is the infection frequency decreasing or not? Is it continuing and persisting? Is it affecting his activities of daily living over the long term rather than in the acute first 2 years of life? All those things you have to ask yourself before you say it's outside normal. Because we all have to go through it. Anybody in this room who has children knows that kids go through a series of infections in the first 2-3 years of life, especially, you know, if they're in daycare, especially if they go to parks, if they go to malls, if they're not, they're brought outside sort of the family unit. It's just normal, and it's what their immune system's supposed to do. It's supposed to learn when we're young, and we have a little bit of plasticity.
Can there be selective immune deficiencies?
Yes, there can.
And are there selective immune deficiencies that would not have been detected by the immune workup that was done in the Hazelhurst case?
Yes, there are.
And does the ability to develop a specific immune response to tetanus tell us with certainty the ability to develop a specific immune response to other bacteria?
As a general rule, it's a very good indicator. There is one exception to that rule, and that's for the what's called polysaccharide antibodies. And those are for encapsulated bacteria such as pneumococcus, which in children who have a specific immunodeficiency to pneumococcus or polysaccharide antibody deficiency is what it's called, you're unable to form antibodies against encapsulated organisms such as strep pneumoniae, Neisseria meningitidis, and others in that group. Those children present with severe infections, pneumococcal septicemia, pneumococcal pneumonias, meningitis caused by meningococcemia or pneumococcus, and they're evaluated because of recurrence of those types of infections, and they are unable to form those antibodies. There is a vaccine now that allows us to get around that somewhat, but it's not perfect.
Are there specific immune deficiencies to viruses or certain viruses?
Not that have been reported to specific viruses.
I just seem to remember in another case looking at a report of a child that had a specific immune deficiency to varicella, for example, that couldn't generate natural killer cells that would deal with varicella. Does that ring any bells or not?
It's not exclusive to varicella.
That was my recollection.
Okay.
I'm not saying.
Sorry. NK cell dysfunction exists. Usually you have a very low NK cell number. Yates has a normal NK cell number. And it leaves you at risk for acute viral illnesses and tumors and cancer. And these are invasive viral illnesses, so not your typical upper respiratory tract infections, but things that will invade and will cause, for example, a viral encephalitis or a viral pneumonitis. And they are related to defects in the cascade related to the NK cell function and usually related to low NK cell numbers, and are also can be related to specific T cell dysfunction.
Is there any significance in your mind to the physician's decision to change from the first of the from nystatin for the thrush early in Yates' life to the Diflucan later.
Fluconazole?
Does that mean anything?
Because nystatin has been used a lot, there's some resistance to nystatin in the environment. At the time when Yates was a child or young, Diflucan or fluconazole came out as an easy-to-give medication, so it was easy. It's a couple of doses, and it eradicates Candida. So a lot of pediatricians started using it in place of nystatin because they were getting some treatment failures because of resistance. That's sort of been put aside now because we want to use it for other things and we don't want fluconazole resistance. But at the time, it was one of those things that would have been used more frequently.
If a child is moderately ill with otitis media, is that a contraindication to giving the MMR vaccination?
I guess it would depend on what you define as moderately ill. The Red Book says that a physician can choose not to give the MMR vaccine if a child is moderate to severely ill, but excludes the idea of upper respiratory tract infections and their complications as being an indication. And otitis media is a common complication of upper respiratory tract infections.
What is the recommendation for the vaccination with MMR vaccine? When should a child receive the MMR vaccine?
It actually varies depending on where you live in the world. Certainly in North America, our first MMR is given at 12 months. In more developed, underdeveloped countries, the MMR is pushed back a little earlier. It can be given at 9 months of age. The reason that it's not here is that you don't develop perfect immunity at 9 months of age to MMR, and so they want children to be at the older end because we have herd immunity, so that the risk of a measles, mumps, or rubella disease associated with waiting the extra 3 months is significantly less. But in the underdeveloped world where measles kills millions of children, it can be given earlier because even though you're not going to cover all children, you'll reduce the death rate during an outbreak.
Do you see anything in Yates' medical history up through the age of 1 year that indicated that he couldn't have waited for 3 months to receive the MMR vaccination at 15 months rather than 12?
I see no indication that he couldn't have waited. I see no indication that he should have waited.
That's all the questions I have.
I just have one redirect question, Mr. Master. Doctor, is there anything in Yates' clinical picture or the immune testing that was done to indicate that he needed further immune testing for selective immune deficiencies?
No. Yates' infection history markedly decreased. If he had had a primary, if he has an important primary immunodeficiency, he would continue to have infections at a frequency that would increase, and you would predict the severity would worsen as well if he was following that path.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Nothing further.
Is this your trial exhibit here?
Yeah, still there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hold on to that. We're going to need that.
Can we just take a quick 5 minute break between witnesses?
5 minutes. We are in a 5 minute recess. We'll return at 11:35.